This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs. In case you didn't know, and most don't actually, the country is home to more than 7% of global mineral reserves. That's significant. With over 80 different types of minerals, Iran is one of the top 10 mineral-rich countries globally. In total, the country has about 60 billion tons of proven mineral reserves, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world. The mining ministry says the total production value in this sector is over $700 billion. This value has not been unnoticed by the government, which has been seriously pursuing several programs promoting the mining sector. Despite its enormous riches, Iran has yet to unlock its full potential as this key sector is still struggling to operate at full capacity. There are several reasons for this. One is a lack of necessary machinery and equipment for expanding this industry. So, the government is focusing on geological exploration, extraction, and research of new products as part of areas for development. Another one of the government's programs to increase production is to increase mineral extraction. So, organizations have embarked on reviving idle mines. Out of 10,000 mines in the country, around 4,000 of them are idle. It's noteworthy that over the last 2 years, some 500 small-scale idle mines have been brought back to life. That's based on the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization. One of the benefits of the ongoing revival plan has been the rise in nationwide employment. Presently, well over 100,000 miners are at work in the sector. Mining in Iran has more work to be done, and it's still under development. Still, there are plenty of doers in this country, and plenty more waiting for further investment opportunities. Iran's productions by far outweigh its domestic use, leaving lots of room for mineral exports. The industry is export-oriented, as a matter of fact. Figures from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show a record high of nearly $12 billion worth of minerals and mining products were exported last year. This means there was roughly an 80% increase in exports year on year. Championing the export list in terms of value were steel ingots and related products, copper, aluminium, zinc, and iron. This is a pretty big growth spurt, actually. But government officials say export figures could be much higher if raw materials and other mining products could be further developed with added value. So, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized products in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role. The current Iranian calendar year slogan was knowledge-based production and job creation. The title was given by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The goal is to promote and increase support for companies that engineer and produce advanced products that contribute to the economy.
Well, it's that time of the show where I should step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague is actually out there on the field. So, let's see that report.
In the modern world today, both industrialized and developing countries have modern installations capable of highly efficient fabric production. In addition to mechanical improvements in yarn and fabric manufacture, there have been rapid advances in the development of new fibers, processes to improve textile characteristics, and testing methods allowing greater quality control. Today, we visited Aram Takmil Teyfe Faro's company, active in the textile industry in Iran.
Hello.
this company, there are various activities such as processes of weaving, dyeing and finishing, and printing of different types of textiles while employing the strongest technical staff as well as modern European dyeing and finishing machines to finally meet customer satisfaction with quality products and innovations. Iran's textile industry has a capacity to produce a wide variety of products suitable for different market segments, both within Iran and across the world. Over the past years, close to 30,000 tons of different types of textile were imported. Presently, however, there are 78 textile factories active in the country, producing 90 million square meters of different kinds of fabric every year. Iran's Development Plan Vision 2025 has identified textile and clothing as one of the potential industries for expansion. The plan basically emphasizes on the need for technological advancements and improvement in productivity.
Many thanks for that awesome adventure, as always. Now, it's time to dive right into some of the latest developments and trends in Iran's agriculture industry. One trend is Iran's agriculture sector. It's a shift towards greenhouse cultivations. Now, a young entrepreneur from Khorasan Razavi province has engineered aeroponic cultivation towers, which can potentially save the country millions on imports.
It is basically an advanced form of hydroponics used in greenhouses. These are vertical circular structures with several openings where plants are placed nutrient-rich liquid, so they efficiently grow more colorful, tastier, and more nutritious produce.
Staying on the topic of trends, farmers have forever battled pests, and some have found better ways to coexist with nature while raising produce. One way is to fight bugs with bugs. A young entrepreneur is marketing his bugs to farmers to reduce pesticide use.
This product is in fact a bunch of tiny insects that are natural predators of certain farm pests that are usually controlled with insecticides. The developers say these creatures only live for a few days, so they don't pose a threat to the natural ecosystem of farms.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition. I'm Samson Sees. See you soon.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
History of knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam, and welcome to the program. The year 2022 was dubbed by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of knowledge. As per the UNESCO motto of the year 2022, more serious attention has been paid to sciences like physics, chemistry, math, geology, biology, statistics, and genetics. Planning and execution of events related to basic sciences, promotion of programs to familiarize various nations with their notables in basic sciences, and acquaintance with the global capacities of this domain were among the programs of last year. In this new series, we are going to make you familiar with the past record of basic sciences in Iran and the innumerable services that Iranians have rendered to mankind through centuries. Basic sciences play an important role in execution of developmental programs. For instance, they provide us with necessary tools to face vital challenges, such as global access to food, energy, hygiene, and communication technologies. Basic sciences are the fundamentals of technological progresses. Moreover, training of specialists and development of life conditions require the growth and development of basic sciences. History of production of sciences in Iran dates back to very old times. Knowledge was venerated and respected so much so that poets would versify poems on the issue. The globally renowned poet Abul Qasim Ferdowsi was one of such poets. Among other poets who have glorified knowledge, mention can be made of Rudaki, Samarqandi, Nasir Khosrow, Saadi, and so on. Nasir Khosrow says in a poem that if you achieve knowledge, you will dominate over the sky. Islam has put a special emphasis on acquisition of sciences, and different sciences are highly recommended, particularly those which are more useful for mankind. In view of this, scholars, scientists, and researchers are highly respected. Although Iran, due to its unique geopolitical situation, diverse climates and endless resources, has been subjected to cruel assaults of different invaders, it has attracted the beauties of invading cultures and highly impacted them. Therefore, today, one can find countless customs, vocabulary, and inventions among many nations which have their roots in Iran's rich culture. Iran used to be known as the cradle of sciences. For example, Muhammad ibn Zakaria Khwarazmi devised algorithm which revolutionized the science of algebra. Hence, he founded the basis for Indian and Iranian arithmetic system. This caused Europeans to change their numerical system from Latin into Indian. Al-Khwarazmi's inventions had a fundamental impact on advancement of math in Western countries. Medicine has had a bright record in Iran, and many books have been written in this field. Iran has played a significant role in expansion of sciences in ancient Greece and has also been influential in the Indian medicine. Jondishapur University in Ahvaz was a noted academic center in old Iran, and many students would come to it to study sciences, particularly medical sciences, as there was a hospital adjacent to the university, which has been claimed to be the first hospital in the modern meaning of the word. This hospital enjoyed separate wards for different patients and various medical services. Mohammad Zakaria Razi, the renowned Iranian physician, chemist, and philosopher, was the first person to use experimental medicines to cure diseases. He discovered alcohol, sulfuric acid, chloric acid, and citric acid. He attained many achievements in medicine, so that George Sartain has called him the greatest physician of Islam and Middle Ages. Apparently, Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, authored his Al-Qanun book through inspiration of Razi's Al-Hawi. Nearly 1,000 years ago, Abu Reyhan Biruni, another globally noted Iranian genius, wrote an encyclopedia on astronomy wherein he has discussed the rotation of the Earth around the Sun. A long time before the Danish Tycho Brahe, he drew the first map of the sky using the pictures and figures of animals to describe heavenly constellations and bodies. In 10th century AD, the prominent Iranian astronomer and mathematician Abdurrahman Sufi studied the stars and for the first time registered the galaxy without the help of a telescope. He discovered the nebula chained woman on Andromeda galaxy. Thus, he corrected the views of Ptolemy. Jaber ibn Hayyan was an Iranian chemist and philosopher who is known as the father of chemistry. His discoveries have been gathered in an encyclopedia. This genius devised many methods and invented many tools which are used to date by chemists. Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in the West, was another great Iranian scientist who is famous for his writings on optics and experiments on lens, mirror, and light. He's known as the father of light physics. To name a few other Iranian scientists, mention can be made of the astronomer and mathematician Abu Abbas Fazl Hatam Nehrizi, Banu Musa brothers, who were specialists in math, astronomy, and mechanics. We can also name Abu Zayd Ahmad ibn Balkhi, geographer and mathematician. Abul Wafa Buzjani, mathematician and astronomer. Qiyasuddin Jamshid Kashani, mathematician and astronomer. And Omar Khayyam, astronomer, mathematician and poet. Well, on that note, we have come to the end of this episode. We hope that you have enjoyed this program. Till next episode, goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of this special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally. Visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge a global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seemed to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West imperialism. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has announced the operation of a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Speaking at a televised program, commander of the IRGC Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amirali Hajizadeh, said the new long-range missile is codenamed Pave. The commander said this was to honor the Iranian forces martyred in the Khorasan province. The Brigadier General noted that all of Iran's missiles are now manufactured with precision-guided accuracy, adding that all American bases in the region are within the reach of the Iranian missiles. Hajizadeh said, "We are now capable of targeting American aircraft carriers at a 2,000-kilometer distance. He noted that the U.S.'s superiority has been shaking after Iran developed its new hypersonic missile, which can maneuver outside the Earth's atmosphere and defeat all anti-missile defense systems. In a stern warning also to Europe, the Iranian commander said, "Of course, we have kept a distance at 2,000 kilometers out of respect for the Europeans," adding, "We hope that Europeans would preserve their dignity." The remarks by the Iranian commander came at a time when Europe has done its share of trying to antagonize Iran by closely aligning its Tehran policies with those of the U.S. After all, the European countries, namely France, Germany, and the UK, have been maintaining a hostile posture toward Iran's defensive missile and peaceful nuclear programs. The EU has also challenged Tehran's regional influence and cooperated with Washington in its anti-Iran sanctions. Needless to say that last month, the European Parliament approved an amendment calling on the European Union and its member states to include the IRGC on their terror list. The resolution drew strong reaction from Iran. IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Salami, warned that the Europeans would suffer the consequences of the move. The 27-nation bloc has also been slapping more sanctions on Iran over what it calls the country's approach toward foreign-backed riots that erupted in some Iranian cities in September. The recent IRGC announcement comes as the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the country's military to increase its efforts to attract, nurture, and train capable Iranians in line with the Islamic Revolution military doctrine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on the IRGC to use its full capabilities to be able to protect the revolution and to strengthen the IRGC's spiritual and military foundations. This can be clearly highlighted in General Hajizadeh's comments when he addressed the issue of Iran's growing missile power. He has enumerated features of the country's hypersonic missile that was manufactured late last year and announced a new cruise missile's inclusion in the list of IRGC's military hardware. This brings to the spotlight the military might of the Islamic Republic, which includes capabilities of Iran's army with its latest underground base for fighter jets and more particularly the country's missile power in the face of the West's threats. That comprises threats coming from Israel, with the regime targeting several military sites in the city of Isfahan lately. While U.S.'s benefit lies in creating regional insecurity, as General Hajizadeh put it, there needs to be a military power in the region to deter such threats. Tehran believes that Washington is a root cause of almost all global conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. The Islamic Republic argues that the West Asia region sits on a security fault line, given the history of conflicts in the past four decades. Another factor that Tehran has always highlighted is the need to maintain the country's military might. It says if it fails to be strong, the enemy will bring the war inside Iran. That's why Iranian military commanders urge and advise Iranian armed forces to meet the security needs of the nation. Given all the threats posed by the U.S. and its allies, the Corps has always been aiming to render the American war machine ineffective and thus has managed to bring all the U.S.'s regional bases within the range of its defensive firepower. They have also turned Washington bases in the region into its weak spots, with the IRGC having the ability to strike U.S. outposts whenever the need arises.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles. This particular test, however, was different. Even North Korea's media reported it that way. Strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word, counterattack. North Korea has been very clear about its missile tests, and there's nothing new there. It has been in response to the U.S. joint war games in the region, whether with South Korea or Japan. However, now it has described the weapons as strategic, suggesting that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The scenario of North Korea's missile launches and the types of ballistic missiles came into full gear in the year 2022, during the U.S. presidency of Joe Biden. North Korea fired more than 70 ballistic missiles, the most ever. But why would these launches increase so much during Joe Biden's tenure? One reason, the U.S. lack of a foreign policy approach towards North Korea. Just war games and condemnations. The U.S. has even flown B-52 bombers in its war games. High-ranking U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham once said, quote, "If there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there." Sanctions have been exhausted. Yet what has been missing is diplomacy or some kind of peace process. But the U.S. has no appetite for that. The U.S. track record shows that it chooses military solutions to foreign policy problems. But why, when in the case of North Korea, given that it has intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. mainland? In the past, the U.S. has used the preventive approach. The U.S. has in its attack doctrine preventive strikes, which differ from preemptive strikes in that they would not be a response to imminent attack from an enemy. Preventive military action has become a popular option among U.S. officials, culminating with George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. But there's a more important reason. The U.S. may simply use this approach towards North Korea in order to make it give concessions. That, along with the U.S.'s long-sought prize, China. The U.S.'s coming war with China is now perceived as not a matter of if, but when. The telltale signs are there. From the U.S. National Security Reports, which cite China as the number one threat to U.S. national security, to arming allies in the region, like Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. For example, Tokyo just recently announced a record 26.3% increase in its defense spending, which will include missiles capable of reaching China. And then there is Taiwan, which aside from arming it to the tune of billions of dollars, the U.S. will be sending more troops to the island. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, possible showdown with Russia, its military threats against Iran, and its potential conflict with North Korea and China. Open Society Foundations described it best when it said, "America is in a constant state of war, and its founding values are approaching annihilation."
Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. The iconic leader was born in 1925 and was jailed for robbery in 1946. In prison, he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and became influenced by the teachings of its leader. He was assassinated at the age of 39 on the 21st of February 1965 by three men. Now, after 58 years, his daughter says federal agencies concealed evidence of his murder and she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police, and others for his death. Eliza Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agency conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages.
"For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you."
The slaying of the black leader has been the subject of speculation about the potential involvement of secret government agencies in his assassination. Back then, the FBI infiltrated black rights movements in a bid to dismantle them. Malcolm X was a lead spokesman for the Nation of Islam. The group advocated separatism for black Americans. Malcolm X later split from the organization and toned down some of his radical views. In the 1950s, the United States reckoned with its prevalent racism, and Malcolm X's assassination was a turning point back then. The civil rights movement, which was a campaign to abolish racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement throughout the United States, culminated in the 1960s. Various individuals and groups, most notably Martin Luther King, struggled to rid the United States of its institutional racism. But despite years of struggle and some success, structural racism is still rampant in the U.S.
It has failed, and it's very tragic. There's been so much suffering. You know, even when there is progress in the 1960s during what's often referred to as the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, there were gains made, but at the same time that there were legislative remedies made, immediately we see the mass incarceration system beginning. And we see neoliberalism taking hold, which impoverished so many millions of people.
The median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people. And black people are also less likely to benefit from home ownership, the engine of generational wealth in America. Black couples are also more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to be denied a mortgage or a home improvement loan. Furthermore, only about 5.7% of physicians in the U.S. identify as black or African American. This statistic does not reflect the communities they serve, as an estimated 12% of the U.S. population is black or African American. One reason for this disproportionate number is that black people have been historically excluded from medicine, and life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans. A black child born today is likely to live up to 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby.
So if there is not a commitment at the top, if there's not seriousness about acknowledging racism and its impact, then we end up with the situation where we're in now, where the U.S. continually claims to be this racism-free country, when in fact it is anything but.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 4th, 2023. We have also female poets, very good poets. The poem that our female program host recited here today was a very good poem that she had written herself. This is also another point. I'd also like to add that in these recent events, You saw how they worked against hijab and such things. Who were the ones who stood up to these efforts and incitements? The women themselves. The women stood up to them. They, the enemies, had pinned their hopes on these women, whom you say are wearing a bad form of hijab. They pinned their hopes on them. They were hoping that these women who have incomplete hijab would remove it completely, but they didn't. They slammed those propagandists and instigators. The final thing that I would like to say is that despite all the things that I have mentioned, despite all the praiseworthy things that have been mentioned, which are all true,
the world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I must point out, in all fairness, that women are oppressed in some families in our society. Because of a man's physical strength, the volume of his voice, his greater height, and his thicker arms, he abuses women. Women are oppressed. So what is the solution? What needs to be done? We want to safeguard families. The solution is that the laws that are related to family need to be strict and firm so that no man will be allowed or be able to oppress women. The laws should come to the aid of the side that is oppressed. Of course, there are also a few cases where the opposite happens. That is, the woman is the oppressor. We also come across cases like that. Of course, there are not many cases like that. And most of the cases are as I mentioned before. We hope that, God willing, all of these matters will be corrected. I benefited from what the women said here. I hope that, God willing, all of these issues will have a positive outcome in the best way possible. I ask Almighty God to grant all of you what is good, health and well-being.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
Back in 2011, Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League and sanctioned by the United States, the European Union, and some Arab countries. But it seems that the recent earthquakes have accelerated the process of normalizing relations between Arab countries and Damascus. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Syria's Sana'a News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. Egypt's foreign minister has arrived in Damascus, Syria, in the first such visit by a top Egyptian diplomat since the foreign-sponsored militancy started in Syria more than a decade ago. Sameh Shoukry met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the presidential palace on Monday, 27th of February, reaffirming his country's solidarity with Syria and its preparedness to continue supporting Syrians in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake on 6th of February. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry also conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's greetings to the Syrian leader and called for further development of long-established and friendly relations between the two countries. Sameh Shoukry described relations between Cairo and Damascus as essential for protection of the Arab world against potential threats and challenges, stressing that Egypt will always support any initiative that could help Syria and would serve the interests of all Syrians. President Bashar al-Assad, for his part, underlined the historical significance of Syrian-Egyptian relations, emphasizing that promotion of diplomatic ties among Arab countries will actually improve living standards in the Arab world. He also appreciated Egypt's warm welcome of Syrian refugees following the outbreak of the crisis in his country, stating that such a behavior attests to the strong ties that already exist between the two nations. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry told reporters upon arrival in Damascus, he said, "The goal of this visit is primarily humanitarian and to pass on our solidarity from the leadership, the government and the people of Egypt to the people of Syria." The development comes only a day after several Arab parliamentary speakers and high-level legislators arrived in Damascus to restore Syria's membership to the Arab League, which was suspended nearly 12 years ago due to the foreign-sponsored conflict in Syria. The lawmakers were received by Syria's Speaker of Parliament, Hamouda Sabbagh, who stated that Syria's return to the Arab diplomatic fold is crucial for any joint Arab action to confront the current challenges and crises. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has received a delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union, which is in Damascus to discuss restoration of Syria's membership to the Arab League after more than a decade of suspension from the 22-member bloc. The meeting took place after the heads of the Iraqi, Jordanian, Palestinian, Libyan, Egyptian and Emirati parliaments, as well as representatives from Oman and Lebanon, arrived at Damascus International Airport on Sunday, 26th of February. President Bashar al-Assad said, "The delegation's visit to Syria today means a lot of the Syrian people, as it indicates the support to the Syrians, who are exposed as a result of the terrorist war and the repercussions of the earthquake. Appreciating the Arab country's rapid response to help the Syrian people after the devastating earthquake," President Assad said, "the visit also affirms that there are effective Arab institutions capable of taking the initiative in various circumstances and moving in the interests of the Arab peoples." Stressing that the strength of popular institutions comes from the fact that they represent the different spectrums and the different spectrums of society, Bashar al-Assad said, "This diversity is an opportunity for dialogue and searching for common points of strength to be the basis for joint Arab action." For their part, members of the parliamentary delegations expressed their readiness to provide all possible support to the Syrian people to overcome the earthquake, saying, "Syria has never stopped serving the causes of the Arab peoples, considering that the Syrian people are able to overcome the effects of the earthquake just as they were able to confront the war and the blockade imposed on their country." Mohammed al-Halboussi, the president of the Arab Interparliamentary Union, said the delegation came to Syria on behalf of all members of the union to voice support and solidarity with the people of Syria. Mohammed al-Halboussi praised Syria for having opened its doors to all Arabs at various stages and underscored the importance of working at all levels for the return of Damascus to exercise its active role within its Arab surroundings. The president of the Arab Interparliamentary Union said, "We cannot do without Syria, and Syria cannot do without its Arab surroundings, which we hope it can return to." The Arab League suspended Syria's membership in November of 2011, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on opposition protests. Syria has denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter. Syria was one of the six founding members of the Arab League back in 1945. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has visited Oman and met with Oman's Sultan Haytham bin Tariq al-Said. Following the devastating earthquake which rocked the northwestern sector of the country 2 weeks ago, claiming the lives of thousands of people, President Bashar al-Assad and his accompanying delegation landed at Muscat International Airport recently and were received by the Omani monarch. President Assad and Sultan Haytham bin Tariq al-Said later held a face-to-face meeting at Beit al-Baraka Royal Palace in Sib near Muscat, where the Omani king offered his condolences to the Syrian government and the Syrian people with regards to the earthquake. He also stressed his country's unflinching support for Syria in order to help the country cope with the aftermath of the earthquake and the repercussions of the foreign-sponsored militancy, as well as the unilateral sanctions imposed by the West on Damascus. For his part, President Bashar al-Assad expressed his gratitude to the Omani monarch, the Omani authorities and people for their solidarity with Syria and delivery of humanitarian aid. He also appreciated Oman's support for Syria in the fight against Takfiri terrorism. The talks between the two Arab leaders also focused on age-old relations between Muscat and Damascus, with a special emphasis on expansion of bilateral ties in various fields of common interest. They also exchanged points of view on the latest regional and international developments and efforts underway to guarantee security and stability in the West Asia region. President Bashar al-Assad said Oman has always adopted balanced policies and stances vis-à-vis regional issues, calling for Muscat's stronger role in promotion of relations among Arab countries based on the principle of mutual respect and non-interference in the affairs of others. Oman was one of few Arab countries to maintain diplomatic ties with Damascus after a breakout of foreign-backed militancy in Syria in March of 2011, in spite of pressures from the United States and other Persian Gulf countries. Meanwhile, the Arab and International Campaign to Break Siege on Syria announced plans on 24th of February to launch a popular pan-Arab campaign to confront the Western-led blockade against Syria through an aid convoy in light of the devastating earthquake that has killed over 50,000 people in both Turkey and Syria.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
said Aminolemi Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Egypt's foreign minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shoukry stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shoukry also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Maqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food producing organizations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high carbon fertilizers with low